to?
Killing It.
On Broadway, I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Jennifer.
And hey, Claiborne Elder.
Hello there.
Oh, what a thrill.
I mean, could we love him more? We were so excited. Every time we brought up, should we contact Clay? Jessica's, oh, I love Clay. Oh, I love Claiborne. May we call you Clay? We said, or would you prefer your full name? Claiborne.
You can call me Claiborne. You can call me Clay. Call me Clay.
Okay.
I will call you Jessica and Jen.
Okay.
And I love you both. It's so nice to see you both, hear you both. I can't wait to learn a story from you both.
Oh, you must.
Clay Claiborne, you are a Broadway star, as well as a star of the screen, a DIY star, a baking star. Basically, you can do it all. You're a jack of all trades, but despite how talented you are compared to us mere mortals, we don't want to talk about that whatsoever. I assume that's okay? Great. That's good?
That's fine. Okay. That's totally fine. That's wonderful.
You know what? We've never gotten quite... We do get lovely, fantastic reactions when we bring it up that we don't want to talk about anything career-wise, but that genuine laugh put me over the edge, kids. It made me feel alive, and while you are... You are truly, I mean, I could marry you, all right? I understand that you're already married. I get it. But I would marry you based on your Instagram posts, as it were.
I would welcome you into
Thank you so much. I love a handyman. You're welcome. I love a man who bakes. And here we are. But you know what? Jen is right. We are here specifically in general to discuss true crime. But first, Clay, I must ask you this. The question is, are you interested in true crime? Have you always been interested in true crime? Maybe you're not interested in true crime. And why do you think that we entertainer types are into it?
I am into true crime, like many of us. And I think it's a great question. I think it's because they're real stories. We're also adrenaline junkies. And so the thrill of like the kind of goriness of the details maybe sometimes makes us feel kind of excited just to learn about it. But also just... in the fact that we all are kind of, we're people that like to study psychology, essentially, in trying to figure out who characters are. And what better way to try to figure out who a person is than through, like, the craziest people that are the hardest to understand.
Say no more.
No, that's very well said. And I'd like to confirm as we move forward that you are from Utah, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. I am. And with the last name Elder, may we ask, were you raised Mormon?
I was.
Mormon royalty? Like Claiborne Elder, that's a pretty fantastic name. Are you have a title we should be calling you? No? Okay.
No. Okay. Thank goodness I am Mormon, though, because I have the most Mormon name
you
ever.
You do. I want to be like, hello, my name is Elder Clay.
And I was Elder.
That's right.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, my God. A double whammy, kids.
I know. And growing up in Utah, that's like having the last name Mr. or President.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like every person who saw my driver's license or the first day of school, every teacher would always be like, Clay Elder. Elder.
Oh, gosh. And we just added to it. So you're welcome.
Oh, no.
No, now it's fun. Now it's been, I've been away for a long time. So now I actually love it. Now it's fun.
All right. Well, Elder, thank God you're with us to discuss this very specific case from Utah. As Jen knows, it's one of the cases that I'm obsessed in trying to understand. It makes absolutely no sense to me still after the fact. So to all of our killers listening, good morning, good afternoon, good night, whatever. Clay, listen, we're on a journey, okay? We're on a journey to West Valley City, Utah. So tell us about, tell us about West Valley City. Paint us a little picture before we get into the disappearance and presumed murder of Susan Powell. What is West Valley City, Utah, bringing us?
Well, when I was growing up, West Valley was sort of the other side of the tracks a little bit. It's the west side of Salt Lake City. It's kind of south and west of Salt Lake City. And it's on the other side of the freeway. And the freeway, I-15, is sort of like the far boundary of what is a reasonable place to live. And so West Valley was like a little bit of a rougher neighborhood, you know, as far as neighborhoods in Salt Lake City go. Rougher neighborhood in Salt Lake City is like, ooh, there was trash in the street. But, you know, it was sort of seen that way a little bit.
Okay. All right. Well, now that you've been painted a picture, killers, dive into this case with us, which has haunted many people for quite some time. And so first, we always love to give credit where credit is due. We got our information today from our boyfriend Wikipedia, the Salt Lake Tribune, and MyNorthwest.com. So before we get into the many twists and turns of this specific case, here's a bit of background. Now, it's been 13 years since Susan Cox Powell disappeared from her West Valley City, other side of the tracks, Utah home. And although her case garnered national headlines and she was presumed to have been murdered by her husband, Josh Powell, no charges were ever filed against him. So since her disappearance on December 6th of 2009, her body has not yet been found. And there were a number of attempts by her family and relatives to actually declare her dead. Now, the efforts finally came to fruition on November 14th of 2019 when she was declared legally dead by the state of Utah. Susan's husband was named a person of interest in the investigation into her disappearance. So let's chat a bit about Josh, shall we? Now, Joshua Powell, he was born on January 20th of 1976 to Stephen and Jessica Terica, very cute, Powell in Puyallup, Washington. Now, Joshua's parents had a very dysfunctional marriage caused in large part by Stephen's disaffection with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the LDS Church. So, according to divorce filings by Tarika in 1992, Stephen shared pornography with his son Joshua and his two brothers and refused to teach or enforce limits on certain behaviors. So, I mean, that's a red flag, okay? Now, I might not be very good at finding red flags in the men I date, but that's a red flag. Like, let's just say. I mean, that's big no. So, knowing that, we always talk about this on this podcast too, Clay. We talk about when these kids are younger, we usually have had many conversations about serial killers who are men who have issues as kids and they wind up doing things like killing animals, which Josh did. He allegedly killed a bunch of gerbils belonging to one of his sisters, and he also threatened his mother with a butcher knife. Clay, did you ever do that or?
I never did any of those things. So that's good. That's good. But yeah, that's some raised flags. Did they say like sharing pornography with kids? That's probably.
I'm going to call that the biggest of the red flags. We don't like it. And it would also, seemingly be no surprise to me that Josh attempted suicide on at least one occasion because of probably all of this disruptance during his childhood. So by 1998, Josh was living in Seattle and he was a student at the University of Washington. And it was here that Powell began his first relationship with a young woman named Catherine Terry Everett, whom he met at a local LDS church congregation. And after the two moved into an apartment together, Josh became pretty possessive towards her. So, quote, he would have restrictions and limitations on what I could and couldn't do when it came to my family, she later recalled. And then she said, if I was going to go visit them, he had to come too. I couldn't go by myself.
Not great.
I don't like possession. Yet another red flag. So when Everett visited a friend in Utah without Joshua, she made the decision to not return to Seattle and she broke up with him over the phone. Good for you, girl. And right? Yeah. This is very good because who knows what would have happened. So then we move on to very shortly thereafter where Josh meets Susan Cox, who is a classmate at his LDS Church Institute of Religion course. Now, this is during a dinner party. Now, Clay, let me go back here. Have you had this LDS Church Institute of Religion course?
Yes. So basically when you're Mormon and you grow up in Utah, during high school, you have seminary. So every day you have an hour of school that you are released from your school, quote unquote, and you walk into the parking lot to a separate building that is owned by the Mormon church, and you go to school for an hour and study Mormonism, right? So everybody does it in high school. In college, it's a similar thing, but it's called institute, where like there's a building on campus that's for Mormons to go and study Mormonism, like you have your Mormon classes.
Wow.
There.
God, yeah. That's a lot of
and
class.
And church will also be there. It's a lot of class.
God. Well, clearly that's where they met. And it was during a dinner party at his Tacoma apartment in November of 2000. So these two fell fast, they began a relationship and eventually married in the Portland, Oregon temple in April of 2001. So Joshua had a bachelor's degree in business, and he worked for a number of different companies over the years, while Susan was a trained cosmetologist, and she took up a job with Wells Fargo Investments after the family's relocation to West Valley City, Utah. And the Powells then went on to have two sons, Charles, who was born in 2005, and Braden, who was born in 2007. Now, for a brief period following their wedding, Joshua and Susan lived at Josh's father, Stephen Powell's home in South Hill, Washington. So, this is so icky. It was unbeknownst to Susan initially, okay? But her father-in-law, Stephen, developed an obsessive infatuation with her, which, like, ew. It's so creepy. And of course, Susan and Josh lived with him at the time. And this is an absolutely not for me. This is like, this is a timeout. Like, if I found out that my father-in-law was doing that, this is like, I'm calling the FBI, CIA, and all of my friends on NBC.
And they're living together. The kids are in the house. And
yes. Oh, yes. And you know what you'll, go ahead, Clay, please.
I was just going to say, you know, what's interesting is that they got married in the temple, which means that they were both temple worthy, which means that technically on the books of the church, they were both like being good Mormons, because you can't get married in the temple unless you're like in really good standing, like the highest standing you can
be. Oh my.
So it surprises me that he was able to get married in the temple, because it sounds like he was not doing a great job being a Mormon.
Sounds like he has some issues, honey. And I will say, just to tack on to this, there are so many documentaries and there's so many things that have been made, especially with home videos of Susan's and Stephen's and everybody's, where you can see this kind of stuff and you can see this footage, which is, it's horrendous to watch, because you see this obsessive infatuation happening in what you would call real time in her footage and in his footage, and he would film her, and it was so gross. And, you know, he followed her around the house with a camcorder. He used to like spy on her with a mirror while she used the bathroom. He stole her underwear from her laundry. He read her journals, and he wrote songs about her, like 100% real deal, like love songs that you hear like MIDI file, like the worst, like my love for you is like a rainbow, like that kind of song.
Oh my God.
And he posted all of these songs online under a pseudonym, Dr. Samard.
I was just going to say, what was his pseudonym? Like, I'm definitely not Steven.com.
Right.
Susan, it's not Steven. That's his name.
But I mean, like, I'm going to say to you that I feel it could be Italian hands that I'm doing right now on Zoom. Nobody can see this, but just know I'm using my Italian hands because I'm passionate.
Hey.
I'm passionate. Hey, I'm a Joey Bag of Donuts. But my thing is, he kind of alluded to the entire thing happening, which Steven obviously has some effing issues happening as well inside of his own brain. But I feel that knowing after the fact that he did all of this stuff so blatantly in the open was kind of a thrill for him. I'm going to just throw that out there. Like, he lived on the edge of like, I wonder if she's going to know. And I think that she loves me too. And it was pretty grody. And in 2003, this is when Steven confesses his amorous feelings to Susan. He says to her, I know you're married to my son, but I love you, honey. And she's like, no. She rejects him completely. And inadvertently, this specific encounter was captured by Steven's camcorder microphone. So they have the footage of this happening where she's like, and she's trying to do the thing that all of us ladies have done in the past, where somebody says to you like, hey girl, I'd like to take you to dinner. You're looking sassy today. And you're like, oh gosh, I have a boyfriend. Even if you don't have a boy, you're like, thank you. So I'm flattered, but I have to wash my hair. It's weird. So that's like, she felt so awkward. You could totally see this in captured footage, and you can really put yourself in that position of being like, oh, this feels so goosebumpy wrong. And
captured footage.
Can you believe? So you have to go look at it, honey.
Oh, now I have to. Ugh, I've got to.
Can you guys just imagine either of your parents falling for and hitting on your significant other? I cannot.
No,
like,
honey.
My late mother loved my husband. She used to call him her Sil. My Sil of my Sil, her son-in-law. She loved him. But I cannot imagine Yvette, one of the healthiest women I knew. Just such a great gal, a gal's gal. I cannot imagine her being like, hey there.
Oh.
I'm just gonna, no, don't mind my camcorder. No, what?
I want to get some of that.
Oh, yeah, God. I would, are you kidding me? I would be like, you are excommunicated, Mom. I couldn't possibly even think of something like that because it's so gross. And so, but I mean, are we that surprised knowing this now, knowing that his dad showed him porn when he was a kid? I mean, mm-hmm. Something is totally off about this. And I'm sure Susan may or may not have known that information, but when she met Stephen, I don't think she knew that he was going to be like, I'm getting your underwear from the, it's so gross. Yeah. So here's actually where it gets pretty spooky.
And I think Clay's going to think it's spooky here too, because this is all in retrospect. So Susan kept several journal entries and an email correspondence, which indicated that there was some marital discord happening. Okay. There was tension with Josh because he started to refuse, to your point, Clay, of attending church services with his family. And he had continued contact with his father, Stephen, despite his father's advances towards Susan. So Josh knew about all this. And then Susan's friends also pointed to Josh's extravagant spending habits and very extremely controlling behavior towards Susan. So knowing all of that and knowing that he had all these crazy extravagant spending habits, he files for bankruptcy in 2007. And he declares over $200,000 in debt. And here's where it spooks Phil. Susan decides to record a video, which again, if anybody goes online into the atmosphere of the intrawebs, you can find this, because she records a video in 2008 in July, and she's surveying property damage, which she attributes to Joshua. And she wrote a secret will at this time that included the following, quote, I want it documented that there is extreme turmoil in our marriage, and if I die, it may not be an accident, even if it looks like one, end quote.
Scary. That's terrifying that it's documented.
I mean, this woman, clearly a very smart woman, clearly had a lot of red flags poking at her, and clearly decided, like, number one, she probably didn't know what to do. Number two, she's got two kids. And decided to document this, which I think sort of helped really figure out what happened in this entire situation, because all of that's pretty bone chilling to know that somebody did that. Like, okay, just so you're aware, there's a lot of shit going down in my marriage. And number two, if something happens to me, it's not an accident.
I don't know which is worse, being completely blindsided by that horrific experience should it happen, or dreading that horrific experience. You know what I mean? Like being completely shocked that your spouse, oh my gosh, you're trying to kill me, or being like, I think he might try to kill me.
Oh my God. I don't even know how you, the anxiety of it. Jeez. I mean, Clay, I mean, I'm not married. I mean, I'm married to my ideals, but none of those are going to kill me. But the two of you are married and I can't even fathom if I were, you know, and I've been in several relationships, smoke cigarette, where I would be like, If I thought that this person was going to do some crazy shit to me, I'm out.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that there is a common problem in a lot of stories like this and a lot of domestic stories where, like, a wife feels she can't leave a husband, or a husband feels he can't leave a wife.
So right.
You know, so that is definitely a thing. I will say that it is, Mormonism sort of doubles down on it by, you're married for eternity, and it's very, very serious. And really, there's not really divorce.
Uh-huh.
So even if your husband totally leaves the church, you, and you believe in it, you will think that you need to stay married to him, to save him, to help him, to, you know, that's a very common problem in Mormonism is, and actually being a gay man and knowing a lot of gay Mormon men, that's a very common problem. And like, they will get married and be gay, and women will think that they need to stay married to them because they will save them and they will like help them to be straight.
Oh gosh.
And that sort of is just like this is that sort of problem that is like, clearly she knew something was going wrong. and that she was in danger, but she felt somehow like she couldn't leave.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, though. That problem. I can't even say that I would understand what that's like. You know, I grew up Catholic, but I don't go to church or anything like that. I would consider myself pretty spiritual. And of course, marriage is very serious. But to think that you feel so obligated to your specific religion to save someone, even in dangerous circumstances, is really tough to think about. So that's probably the number one thing, is that she belonged to the church and probably took those vows very seriously, and no judgment there, because I completely agree. But it makes me sad, because I want so many people to live authentically as possible and to be who they are. And it feels so stifling to feel like you can't do that. And it's probably this like battle of the minds and with your own brain. And so that does make it really sad, extra sad.
You know what else is sad? That you haven't had a sip of water in that 75 pages you just read. Would you like a little sip?
Like a little sip of water.
Let's get on to the disappearance of Susan. On the morning of December 6, 2009, Susan, Charles, and Braden attended church services. A neighbor visited them at home in the afternoon, leaving at about 5 p.m. This was the last time Susan was seen by someone from outside the Powell household. At first, the entire Powell family was reported missing on December 7th by relatives. Joshua's mother, Tarika, and sister, Jennifer Graves, went looking for the family at their house shortly after being informed that the children had not been dropped off at daycare that morning. They called the police when they failed to make contact with Joshua and Susan. The police broke into the house, fearing that the family were victims of carbon monoxide poisoning. They found no one inside, but noticed two box fans blowing at a wet spot on the couch. Susan did not show up at her job on December 7th. Her purse, wallet, and identification were all found at the house, which no one does that. No one, right?
Nobody just leaves it there. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, Jessica, we went through this.
We know what that means.
The Watts family murder. The same thing with Shanann. That's not normal.
That's not right.
So her cell phone was later found in the family's only vehicle, a Chrysler Town & Country minivan that Joshua had been using.
Now I'm back.
That's all right. She's back. Now, at around 5 p.m. that day, Joshua returned home with the two boys and was taken to the police station for questioning. He claimed he had left Susan sleeping at home shortly after midnight on December 7th because she was tired and had taken his boys on a camping trip to Simpson Springs in western Utah. Investigators found it suspicious that Joshua would take his young boys out camping in below freezing temperatures. Claiborne, is that unusual in Utah?
That is very unusual in Utah.
Anywhere, really.
He left, like, so he came home. He says that she was sleeping. So he said, I'm going to take the boys camping right now.
In the middle of the night. Yeah, what a great idea.
And somebody believed that story?
Jessica's got her voice on. So
because when it's again, it's snowing. Hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't go camping in a blizzard. Right. God, it's just driving me nuts.
Yeah.
No.
So on December 10th, police visited Simpson Springs, but found no evidence of the campsite that Joshua had described. Yeah. They also found it suspicious that Joshua would take his young boys out camping in blizzard conditions after midnight when he was scheduled to go to work at his job just hours later. I mean, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's riddled with holes, the whole story. I know Clay is sitting there awfully confused, and you should be.
It sounds like It sounds like an excuse my 3-year-old son would give. Mm-hmm. Like if I caught him doing something, he'd be like, but I needed to go meet the president at his house, so I drove there.
We have an ongoing series here, Clay, where we're just like, but I didn't do it. Ugh. You know, like that's what you do. But I saw you hit your brother. I didn't. No, I literally saw you smack him in the arm.
I've done it. That's my story of my life when I was 3. Mm-hmm. Jessica, did you pinch your brother? No. Are you sure? Yeah. I saw you pinch him. No. I mean,
yeah.
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 Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song, Killing It.
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
So now the fact that her cell phone was present in the vehicle, that part too, that just added to the evidence of foul play. I think we can all agree. Now, Joshua had not told his boss that he would not be coming into work that day and explained to police it was because he had thought it was Sunday rather than Monday. So this is a quote from Susan's friend, Kiersey. Quote, as soon as I heard that he was back and Susan was not with them, I instantly said to myself, what has he done? Kiersey Helliwell, Susan Powell's friend, said, quote, Susan would have never allowed him to ever take the boys out in the winter to the desert in the middle of the night. Never. I never believed his story at all. End quote. Everyone needs a best friend like that. It's like Shanann Watts' best friend. Same thing. She just knew. You know? Anyway. So upon...
And her last name is Helliwell?
H-E-L-L-E-W-E-L-L. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Yes, I had a girlfriend in college named, well, whose last name was Helliwell, and they must be related because
is this her?
In Utah's Helliwell. No, I don't know this woman. I don't know this woman's name, but they must be related somehow. Anyway.
Uh-huh. The plot.
It's a small world.
The plot thickens.
Sure do. So,
tis thick.
Upon searching the Powell residence on December 9th, investigators found traces of Susan's blood on the floor, life insurance policies on Susan for $1.5 million, and a handwritten letter from Susan expressing fear for her life. DNA test results released in 2013 matched one blood sample with Susan, while another sample was determined to have come from, quote, an unknown male contributor. In August 2012, West Valley City Police released documents showing that Joshua took actions that were regarded as highly suspicious following Susan's disappearance. Joshua liquidated Susan's retirement accounts, canceled her regularly scheduled chiropractic sessions, and withdrew his children from daycare. He had also previously spoken to coworkers about how to hide a body in an abandoned mine shaft in the western Utah desert. What a guy. Just a casual at the water cooler. So anybody know how to... bury a body in a mine shaft. No one? Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's...
And I'm trying to imagine that phone call to the chiropractor's office as well. Just, hi, I need to cancel my wife's appointment. Why do you need to do that? I'm going to murder her.
I know.
Sure you are. Call us back to reschedule. That's fine.
Another game of Dungeons and Dragons. Am I right? I mean, just like, it's bizarre. Yeah. It's just bizarre. And...
who thinks to do that? That's...
That ain't right. And Clay, how old is your son?
Three.
He's three. Okay. So this is where we get into the area of the investigators who interview the children. And these kids are really young. I think the youngest was five at this time. The eldest was seven. And this was the tricky area when it comes to investigations, right? Because we've seen children be interviewed before, and sometimes they have leading questions, so the kids don't necessarily know. They try and say the right thing versus saying what's really the truth. So it gets really tricky with psychologists coming in and investigators coming in and asking the right questions. So police interview the couple's eldest son, Charlie, who's 7 years old at the time, who confirmed that the camping trip did take place. However, unlike his father, he stated that Susan, his mother, had gone with them, but she didn't return. And weeks after her disappearance, a teacher reported that Charlie claimed that his mother was dead. And furthermore, Susan's parents, Chuck and Judy Cox, claimed that while at daycare several months after the disappearance, Susan and Josh's youngest, Braden, drew a picture of a van with three people in it and told the caregivers that, quote, mommy was in the trunk. So...
oh my God.
Investigators, they informed the media that they plan to question Joshua again. And they subpoenaed all footage and interviews, aired and unaired, of Joshua from local television stations. And on December 14th, what did Joshua do? Well, he retained an attorney in connection with the investigation. And police said that he grew increasingly uncooperative. Surprise, surprise. So a few days later, he took his sons to... Puyallup,
to stay with his father, Stephen, for the holidays. And by December 24th, Josh was now considered a person of interest in this investigation. On January 6th of 2010, he returned with his brother, Michael, to pack the family's belongings, indicating that he was moving permanently to Puyallup.
Now, we haven't even scratched the surface, so get thee ready, y'all. In Puyallup, Joshua occupied a home with his two sons, his father Stephen, his brothers Michael and Jonathan, and his sister Alina. Joshua indicated that he would rent out his house in Utah. It was reported that he returned to Puyallup after he had lost his job. Soon afterwards, the website SusanPowell.org was launched, described as, quote, the official website of Susan Powell. The site's anonymous entries defended Joshua as the victim of a smear campaign by Susan's family, his estranged sister Jennifer, and the LDS Church. Additional posts also speculated that Susan's disappearance was connected to that of Stephen Kesher, a former journalist who vanished the same week as Susan, and that the two had run off to Brazil together. Joshua and Stephen were widely believed to have written these posts. In late 2010, both men claimed that Susan had abandoned her family due to mental illness and that she had left with another man. Susan's family rejected these claims as being, quote, unsupported by any evidence. That
now,
poor family.
I do want to just say, we briefly just like breezed over the Jennifer, who's Josh's sister. She actually had a lot to do with trying to get coax a confession or get him to tell the truth. Is she like, she wore a wire. She was working with investigators and police because she's his sister. And honestly, when your immediate family member says, I think something's up and I think my brother had something to do with it, that's where I'm like, and when she says, I'm willing to try and get this information for you, that's where I'm like, yes, he absolutely did this. Not that I wasn't before, really, but you're his sister. That's something. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So police also turned their attention to Michael after learning that he had sold his broken down Ford Taurus to a wrecking yard in Pendleton, Oregon, shortly after Susan's disappearance, and had later ordered satellite images of the lot. When police found the car, a sniffer dog indicated that a decomposing human body had been in the trunk. DNA tests on the car proved inconclusive. I just was thinking of that little child's drawing that mommy's in the trunk, you know.
Yes.
Jeez, God.
So sad.
I just keep thinking about you, Claiborne, as the father of a 3-year-old. I mean, it's horrific. I can't imagine.
No, it's really unimaginable. And Joshua's whole family situation just seems so dark. And to run to his father and then suddenly all of this kind of, this website launches, all of this like counter smear attack goes on to protect him. It's really creepy.
It is creepy. So now we're up to September 14th of 2011, where Utah authorities discover a possible grave site while searching a place called Topaz Mountain, which is in a desert area near, is it called Nephi? Do you know that, Clay? Or
Nephi.
Thank you.
Nephi.
A desert area near Nephi that Joshua had frequented as a campsite. So there were signs of recent soil disturbance and shoveling, but after digging a few feet down, police were unable to find any remains. In spite of being careful in sifting the soil, and federal anthropologists also ruled out the possibility of the site being an ancient burial ground. Now, police continued to examine the site for a bit of time, but offered no explanation as to why they previously announced the finding of remains when none had actually been confirmed. Authorities said they were following a scent detected by their sniffer dogs.
Wow.
I know.
So relations between and within the Powell and Cox families became increasingly hostile, as you could imagine. So after a police raid in their home in 2011, both Joshua and Stephen spoke to major news outlets regarding journals that Susan had allegedly written about the relationship between Stephen and herself. Stephen claimed that he and Susan had been falling in love prior to her disappearance, and he cited the content of the journals, written when Susan was a teenager, as evidence to support his theory that she was mentally unstable and could have run away with another man. A judge issued a permanent injunction forbidding Joshua and Stephen from publishing any material from Susan's journals, ordering the pair to either return or destroy any journals already published. Stephen, to me, he strikes me as this person who he thinks he's one of the siblings. Like, he thinks that he and his son are equals. There literally are no boundaries whatsoever.
Well, best pals, friends, not father, son. There's a total messed up
relationship here. Zero boundaries. But when it comes to good news, on September 22nd, Father Stephen was arrested on charges of voyeurism and child pornography after police found evidence that he had secretly videotaped numerous women and young girls, including Susan. Now, John Long, who is the assistant attorney general for Washington State, said that Joshua was a, quote, subject in the child pornography investigation. And a friend of Stephen claimed that he was preoccupied with pornography and, quote, was hung up on Susan sexually. Chuck Cox, Susan's father, filed for custody of Susan's children the day after Stephen was arrested. Thank God.
Thank God.
Ditto. And a Washington court eventually granted Cox temporary custody of the boys, ruling that Joshua would have to move out of Stephen's home if he wanted to regain custody. So, naturally, Josh rented a house in South Hill. But authorities later alleged that he had never actually moved into that house, merely making it appear as if he had satisfied the court's instructions while continuing to reside at his father's home.
So in late September 2011, Joshua's sister Jennifer stated that she believed Joshua was, quote, responsible for his wife Susan Powell's disappearance, end quote. His other sister Alina had also been suspicious of him as well. However, she later withdrew her suspicions and felt that Joshua had been unduly harassed by the investigation. By this time, West Valley City had spent more than $500,000 picking up garbage. No, I'm kidding. On the case. On September 28th, Mayor Mike Winder?
I think it's Winder.
Winder. I think Winder.
All right. I'm going to go with the local. Mayor Mike.
That's a very Utah thing.
All right. Mayor Mike Winder. I have a confession. We often look up pronunciations, but when we really do have a local who lived right where it happened, we like to ask you. So thank you for helping us. All right.
Of course.
So Mayor Mike Winder indicated that he felt that the case was worth the expense, stating, quote, we feel that we are getting to that tipping point where we have more hot evidence than we had in the past 2 years, end quote, and that the case was moving forward.
So here we are in 2011, where Joshua undergoes a series of court-ordered evaluations in Washington. Thank you, court. So the evaluations by James Manley determined that Joshua had adequate parenting skills, a steady employment history, and no criminal record or history of domestic violence. However, Manley also raised issues concerning the ongoing criminal investigations, Joshua's failure to admit normal personal shortcomings, his overbearing behavior with his sons, and his persistent defensiveness and paranoia attributed to the police and media attention in conjunction with underlying narcissistic traits. I would say so. So the initial recommendation was for Joshua to have visitation with his sons several times a week, supervised by a social worker. Now, in the last week of January 2012, Utah police discovered about 400 images of simulated child pornography, bestiality, and incest on a computer seized from the Powell family home. The pornography had been cached when viewed by the previous owner of the computer, which had been purchased by Susan secondhand. However, Utah authorities misled the court and accused Joshua of having viewed the images. And the images, while not illegal due to their being a hand-drawn or cartoonish 3D format, were obviously a cause for great concern to the investigator Manley, partly given Joshua's earlier denial of possessing any such materials. So Joshua was recommended to receive a more thorough psychosexual evaluation and polygraph test. But Manley suggested no change in his visitation schedule with his sons.
Meanwhile, Michael established a Google Sites page which claimed that Susan's parents were abusing and neglecting the boys in collusion with child welfare authorities, and that West Valley City Police had both mishandled the investigation into Susan's disappearance and were harassing Joshua.
And for those who have might be like, wait, Michael's Josh's brother.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Vosk. And this is a good time, since we're paused, to tell you that, Claiborne, your name heretofore on this episode is Dr. Elder. We're all doctors of crime on our show.
Okay. Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Enjoy. So lawyers for the Cox family disputed these allegations, and Google removed the site after a few days due to terms of use violations. On February 5th, 2012, social worker Elizabeth Griffin Hall called 911 after taking Charlie and Braden to a supervised visit at Joshua's house in South Hill. Hall, who was supposed to monitor the visit between Joshua and the boys, reported that he grabbed them and would not let her through the door.
Oh my God, you guys. This is also something that you can listen to. You can literally listen to this 911 call happen. If you go look it up, it is devastating.
I'm not going to do that. Oh, I'm not going to do that.
I don't think I
know,
can do
I know.
It, but that is so haunting that all the documentation on this whole thing is just crazy how it is
some,
laid out.
And some people can, and some people just like, you know, if you can handle it, it's there for you. And yeah, trigger warning, this we're here, folks. So, sorry, soon thereafter, the house exploded, killing Joshua and the two children. Local authorities treated the case as a double murder-suicide, saying that the act appeared to have been deliberate. When authorities notified Stephen, who was in jail, he, quote, didn't seem very upset by the news, but was angry toward authorities who notified him, end quote. 2 weeks later, Stephen invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to answer questions regarding Susan's disappearance. Cox and others have stated they believe that Stephen knew what actually happened to Susan. Stephen was convicted of voyeurism charges in May 2012 in a trial which largely skirted the issue of Susan's case.
It's just, it's devastating. It's really devastating because the woman, and there's a lot of back and forth here about what should the woman who was the supervisor of the children and was taking them on this visit and had, you know, that, oh, did she do the right thing? Is she responsible for this because she wasn't able to get into the house and he sort of like opened up the door, the kids walked in and he was like, bam, closed the door right in her face. And for all intents and purposes, when you hear the 911 phone call, which I've heard like watching documentaries, there are little bits and pieces in there. She's dumbfounded. She's like, she knows something's wrong. First of all, she's like, this is not okay. I'm supposed to be here. It's supposed to be supervised. And the person, if I'm correct, on the other lot, like end of 911, is a bit of an idiot. And like, you know, sorry, what are you talking about? I'm sorry, where are you? And where are you again? So it's almost like so much of this could have been prevented because the woman had to be like, my name is so-and-so and I am with the state of Utah for, you know, child protective services. I'm sorry, but where are you again? So it took so long to get this information. And then all of a sudden, while she's on the phone, the house explodes. So that just gets me right in the feels. And after, you know, of course, a relatively brief investigation of the entire thing, officials finally confirmed that the explosion had been deliberately planned. Yeah, you think? And the official cause of death for Joshua and his two boys, it was determined to be carbon monoxide poisoning. Although the coroner did note that both children had significant chopping injuries on the head and neck, and a hatchet was recovered near Joshua's body, and investigators believe that he did attack the boys with it before being overwhelmed by the smoke and the fumes himself. Now, the fire investigation also found 2 5-gallon cans of gasoline on the premises, as well as evidence that gasoline had been spread throughout the house. Now, friends and relatives of Joshua, they told authorities that he'd contacted them by email minutes before the incident to say goodbye. And some of them, including his local bishop, received instructions for finding his money and shutting off his utilities. And records show that Joshua had withdrawn $7,000 from his bank account and had donated his children's toys and books to local charities the day before the incident. And Joshua did name his brother Michael as the main beneficiary of his life insurance policy. So, you know, those raised some questions for me too, but little Charles and Braden are both buried at Woodbine Cemetery, which also does contain a memorial for their mother, and Joshua's remains were subsequently cremated.
Now, on February 11th, 2013, Michael, apparently he had jumped from the roof of a parking garage. Police had questioned Michael several times in 2012 after discovering his abandoned Ford at the Oregon Wrecking Yard. Michael was, quote, evasive about why he left the car at that location. Utah authorities have since said they believe that Joshua and Michael were accomplices in the murder of Susan. Susan told her friends in dozens of emails the fun-loving, affectionate man she married in her home state of Washington in 2001 had changed into a surly, moody, controlling person she feared could harm her.
Oh, and I think that they were in cahoots as well. Like, I think Michael was questioned enough to make him go, I'm going to take the fall for this. So I've got to just end this. That's my initial thought is like, well, they started to find information. This I do know as reporter Dr. Vosk. And I do know they started to find really subsequent information that put Michael in a very shitty place. And he said, I'm not willing to discuss this. I'm just going to off myself, which is not the right thing to do. But really, really sad. And honestly, this, Clay, I always think this. I always ask our guests, like, these fates can be avoided in these types of cases. I'm often like, okay, well, instead of thinking that you need to kill yourself and your two kids, maybe you should talk to somebody. Or maybe you can, you know, this is the stuff that I don't think about those extremes. So the fact that Susan, for me, kind of gave a cry for help before she disappeared was evidence that something deadly could happen. We didn't get to see any of this until after the fact. So I kind of wonder your take on that, Clay, before we finish this off.
Well, what's fascinating to me about it is he's so methodical. The canceling of the chiropractor appointments, the donating of the toys, it's clear how controlling he is in the way he like plotted out how everything would go.
Oh, yeah.
So it just has to seem like just what you said, red flags that show up. And how can you actually tell when somebody would go so far as to do something like that? Now, I will say, too, that I find this to be one problem with a lot of organized religion. Enjoy as you please your organized religion. But I will say that in my experience of Mormonism, you feel like that is all you, as far as your mental health goes, all you need is your group of spiritual guidance. Yeah. And that is not true. And I think that in this sort of circumstance, somebody on the outside of this situation could have maybe said, you two should be like try a trial separation and start like would have raised some concerns about this relationship and her fear in it.
And the money, you know, a lot of people have money problems, right? A lot of people have money problems. What is that chip that makes someone say, well, I got to get my hands on that life insurance policy. And the only way to do that is killing my spouse. That is something I will never reconcile.
And I think it happens more often than you think. I mean, we hear all these cases all the time where people go, that was the last resort that I could possibly think of. I was in between such a rock and a hard place. But you're right. My brain doesn't automatically go there. I'm like, okay, guess I better pivot. That, you know, that's where my brain goes. And so, you know, but that's one of the sad parts of this story. And we wanted to end this with a quote from Susan, which really sums this up. These are Susan's words, because we here continue to always have faith that someday her body will be found, which will give her family at least the peace that they so deserve, because closure is a tricky word, and it means something different, and the grieving process means something different to everyone. So we always hold the family with the utmost respect and the highest regard. So, but these are Susan's words, quote, I want him in counseling, on meds. I want my husband, friend, lover back. No more crazy, outrageous, outlandish beliefs or opinions. I know everyone else will support me in whatever decisions, even if that means I crash on anyone's house in the middle of the night with my boys in tow. Hope that never happens. Or stay with him. But believe me, my bottom line is he will do counseling. I'm sure if he fixes himself, everyone else will see a much closer version of the guy I married. And it will be easy enough to forget the hell and turmoil he's put me through. End quote.
I remember Jessica wanting to do this story when we were putting this podcast together. I don't know if you remember, Jessica, but I remember. This was one of the ones you said you really wanted to do. And it was requested that we do this story. And Claiborne, you were requested and you were so kind to join us today. Again, having a local, not only a person local to the area, but in your case, a local to the religion, is really an insight that Jessica and I alone could not provide. So thank you for handling it so carefully. And thank you for being here with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, and your course, your insights about, you know, the mind of somebody who is very religious with this specific religion has been very eye opening, because we don't often think about what that means, you know, and that these types of things mean something different to everybody who, you know, is associated with whatever, you said, organized religion they are with. So this is like a eye opening to me, because sometimes, you know, people are silently screaming in their brain trying to figure out what to do, and they feel like they only have one option. So that was very helpful. You are a gem of a human being, and we are so glad and honored that you came to talk to us today.
It is my pleasure and my delight to spend an hour with two people that I admire so much. So
did we depress you? Is that?
A little, but it's going to turn around.
Okay. Well, you know, this is not a fun story. Okay. This isn't your usual fun time podcast.
It's an important one. It's a very important one.
It is. And if anything, you know, we hope that whoever listens to this, or if you know somebody who's struggling, these are the types of things where you can, you know, never feel embarrassed or like you are being too vocal about something, because you could save a life. And that's pretty cool.
So with that, Claiborne, thank you. We love you. Get out of here.
I will. Thank you so much for having me.
Get yourself out of here.
Bye, you guys.
Claiborne's one of those people that I believe everyone likes.
Of course. I mean, first of all, he's a prince. If you look at him, you say he's a prince. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you talk to him and you say he's a prince.
Yeah, some people just have that ability. They just are so genuinely warm and lovely, and he's so likable.
We adore him. We know that you will adore him too, Killers. You probably already do, but you will understand when we say that he is a prince among men. He truly is. So as much as we love Clay, Killers, we love you too. So thank you so much for listening, and until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content, and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.